And we're talking about the secret space age. And we're going to come back in just a moment and check in more on the Admiral Byrd story. That's one that has always fascinated me. Did he fly through a hollow Earth? We'll be back in a moment with Olav Phillips on Coast to Coast AM. Olav Phillips with us. Olav, let's get back into the Admiral Byrd story. Was he in an aircraft at the time?
No, he was in ships. They took a very large number of ships down to the South Pole.
Okay.
But they did have a number of aircraft. They had, Martin Mariners, large seaplanes, and they had fighters. They had a bunch of different kinds of tanks. They pretty much outfitted themselves for a battle.
So as he went into this, let's assume he went into a hollow portion of the planet. Was it just like the curvature? He didn't even know it. He just kind of just kept going right in it.
That's the story. Actually, that element of it, he wasn't an airplane that supposedly went in. And that element of it, yeah, he described having flown in through the hole. And I guess they didn't really, even according to mythology, right, they didn't really even know that they had flown inside of it, that it kind of just arced in, and then suddenly the sky changed, and they started to see strange plants and strange things below them. But yeah, they had no idea. They just kind of flew into a hole, and it kind of kept arcing, and then they ended up in a huge space.
Yeah, he reported the strange animals and everything else.
Right.
And didn't he also say that there were some visitors there, strange-looking beings?
Yeah, he said that there were some odd. I don't know if you describe them as people, but yeah, he reported it. I believe that he saw like a city, and it had strange people in it, and it had strange vehicles and other stuff that they weren't. It wasn't like they were in the Stone Age. I mean, they had aircraft and other things that he had seen while he was flying around in there.
Okay, let's go to some of the phones here. We've got John in Agency, Iowa. Welcome to the program, John. Go ahead.
Good evening, George. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
Doing tonight?
Very good, thank you.
Yeah. Well, I had a question for our guest here tonight, and I was kind of wondering why we bombed the moon about 2 or 3 years ago. I don't know if you guys remember that. I was wondering why we bombed it, because I don't believe it was checked for underground water, because we already would have been privy to that knowledge from being there before. And who or what are we fighting on the moon, and if not also on Mars?
Yeah, I remember that incident. And they've actually done a few things that are like that. They've slammed probes into it and all kinds of stuff. As far as what they would be fighting, over time, I've come to maybe buy into the notion that there is a second breakaway culture that's functioning. There are a lot of reasons why I believe that. I can get into it. But basically, I think we're probably fighting Germans or some sort of the remnants of some sort of Axis group that got up there. So they, you know, they would come and maybe attack us, and we would attack them, and then they would leave. But I think it's you know, World War II extended, basically.
Yeah, that could be. It was the Lottie mission that NASA smashed into the moon to see if they could kick up any water, I guess.
Right.
And I think they probably found out what they wanted to find out. First-time caller Jason is in Paris, California. Welcome to the program. Jason, go ahead.
Hey, how you guys doing tonight?
Okay, Jason, thank you.
I was calling to ask if you have ever heard anything about Project Solar Warden, or is that related to Space Warden that you were talking about earlier? And what have you guys heard about Project Eden? And I'll take my answer off here.
I haven't heard of Project Eden. I'd be very interested in hearing more about it. Solar Warden is different than Space Warden. Solar Warden is what Gary McKinnon found, and supposedly Solar Warden is basically a fleet of ships that fly around inside the solar system doing things and defending us from external threats. And as I said, I think they're defending us from this other breakaway civilization that's functioning out there. Space Warden was an SDI-style program that this gentleman and I discussed, where they had two killer satellites that were in equatorial orbit, and there was a third hunter-killer that was autonomous that would travel around in orbit but under its own control.
And the best I can do with Project Eden, Olaf, is it's a video game. So I don't know if there's any other application after that, but it's a video game.
Well, I'm going to find out. I'm going to check it.
Are you into video games?
Sometimes. It depends.
All right. That's what
Minecraft.
It is. Sparky's with us in Mansfield, Ohio. Hey, Sparky, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, thanks.
I don't want to go against anything your guest is saying, but I have a hard time believing that if we had such a large space program up there, that other countries that may not be exactly in line with us would not point this out.
Well, I think they actually are in line with us. I mean, even during the Cold War, right, if you look at the conventional view of history versus that conspiratorial view of history, even in conventional history, at the height of the Cold War, when the NATO and the Warsaw Pact were completely committed to blowing each other into oblivion, we were still planning a manned moon mission with the Soviets. You know, we docked the Apollo mission with the Soyuz pod. You know, so I think a lot of that kind of contention between us and the Russians or us and the Chinese or, you know, various other countries, I think a lot of that is manufactured. It's a kind of Orwellian scenario where East Asia is always at war with Oceania, which is always at war with, you know, the third country. That this kind of perpetual war machine that exists and this perpetual tension is designed to control the populace.
You write a little bit about the Nazis' UFOs. Tell me about that.
Well, originally the story, it's about the Bell. That's the big one.
The Nazi Bell.
The Nazi Bell. That originally came from a guy named Jacob Sporenberg, who was an SS, I think he was a general, but he was in command of SS units and police units in Scandinavia. And he related a story that he had heard about a top-secret facility near Pilsen called Derisi, the Giant, where a guy named Hans Kammler was working on developing the Bell, which was a kind of anti-gravity engine. And basically, after the war, Kammler packed up the Bell and packed up his top scientists, killed a lot of the slave labor that he was using and the technicians and other things, and he disappeared. And what's interesting about the story is two things. One is that the Keksberg UFO has a striking similarity to the design of the Bell, as we understand it, at least as Igor Witowski, who originally wrote the book that it came from, describes it. And then it has a striking resemblance to it. The second part that's interesting is that Kammler himself, that if Kammler did leave, a lot of conventional thought is that he went to a place called Base 211, which was in New Schwabenland in Antarctica. And the reason that that's possible is because he had several of these things called Junkers 390s, or big J390s, huge transports. And it turns out that they have a range that would get them to somewhere like North Africa or Spain before they need to be refueled. And then from there, they could get to Antarctica, at least almost. But there also, it turns out that there are stories that the Ju-290, which was the smaller version, could actually aerially refuel a 390, even in 1944. So they used this Bell engine to power, I guess you call them flying saucers.
Mm-hmm.
They call them the Hanabu, but they're kind of circular UFO-looking things. And they eventually used those to go into orbit.
Were they given the technology, or did they develop it?
You know, that's a real area of contention. Some people think that they found a crashed UFO and they back-engineered it. Other people think that they actually built it. I'm more of the thought that they built it based on the kinds of scientists that they had at their disposal. And looking at who Kammler was, I mean, he had a PhD in engineering. It was civil engineering, but he had a PhD in engineering. You know, so I tend to suspect that if the Bell is real, which there is evidence that it is, lots of it, you know, I think that they probably built it.
Okay, let's go next to Mary in Bevel, Texas. Hey, Mary, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. My question is, if we are not proactive in being out there in space and trying to develop things to protect us from asteroids and different threats, and also vast amount of space junk and things that are out there, if we're not doing something about it, when it's too late, it's too late. Also, if it's not secret, then everyone else out there can potentially pose a threat to us. If people put something out there that can be a threat to us, if we're not proactive to do something about it, then we're not doing everything we can to protect America.
Well, I think we are, though, Marion. I think it's done, though, in a very secret way. They just don't, Olaf, at any time, roll this technology out.
No, not at all. In fact, conservative estimates put the military level of technology like DARPA, you know, anywhere from 50 to 100 years ahead of where we are today. In fact, there's a quote from the head of the Skunk Works where he said that not only does he have the technology to take ET home, he's got the contract. You know, so I would say they probably have the technology to defend us. I mean, some of the SDI stuff up there could easily take out an asteroid.
That is amazing technology. What about these large triangular-shaped objects that so many people see? I mean, really, a lot of people see this.
They do, and I think that that's part of the program. I think that what you're seeing is a kind of hybrid space plane aircraft, maybe with an anti-gravity motor, but that's what you're seeing. But what's actually more interesting than just the triangular shape is that now people are reporting that they have a kind of adaptive camouflage where they're capturing the star field, because they fly at night, they're capturing the star field ahead of them and actually displaying it on the bottom of the aircraft. So as it goes over you, you can see the star field, but it kind of shimmers. And a lot of people are reporting that. And actually, I think I saw one of those at eSETI.
Let's go to Mark in Fort Lauderdale, Florida now. Hello, Mark. Take it away.
How are you doing there?
Good.
Good. Two things. I don't know... if you ever heard of you heard of the X-15 program back in the late 40s,
yeah,
and end of the 50s. Did you know the X-15 flew 364,000 feet plus, a world record, at a speed of over 7,400 miles an hour? Of course, that was a rocket plane. It had rocket engines in it.
And that was way back then.
This was in 51, like 51. Yeah.
Well,
anyway, another thing I wanted to comment on earlier regarding, our atmosphere and the pollutants in it. Why don't they use accumulators, filter this stuff out, drill deep into the earth into magma chambers, and pump it down into these magma chambers and just burn it up?
I'm not sure why they don't. What I do know is that the end result of alternative one failing, which was Operation Argus Hardtack, was geoengineering, the kind of chemtrails that we hear about. That seems to be the way that they chose to go. There are a number of patents that have been filed by Hughes Aircraft, Boeing, and others that talk about dispersal of particulate matter. So maybe it was cost. I mean, I know it sounds silly that, you know, you're contemplating the end of the world, but it comes down to money. Maybe it was more cost-effective to do solar radiation management and, you know, geoengineering than it was to build accumulators to shove it down.
I think Neil Armstrong, by the way, the late Neil Armstrong flew those X-15s every once in a while. Pretty amazing.
Amazing. It's amazing aircraft.
Yep, it does. What are your next projects, Olaf? What's next for you?
Well, I just recently contributed to a book called The Ark of the Covenant and Other Ancient Weapons. I contributed a chapter on kinetic energy weapons in ancient India. I contributed to another book that's going to be coming out about mysterious civilizations in North America.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff.
The ancient India, I am convinced they possessed weapons. As we know, Vimanas, the flying machines, they had it all.
Absolutely. And according to the Mahabharata, you know, there was a cataclysmic war that actually occurred. And conventionally, a lot of people think that nuclear weapons were actually deployed during that war. There are areas of extreme radiation that you can still find even today in India. But my chapter dealt with, instead of taking it from a point of view of them using nuclear weapons, which have massive half-lives of radiation, then maybe they used kinetic energy weapons like Project Thor.
That's right. West of the Rockies, Joe in Westminster, Colorado. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
How are you guys doing tonight?
Good, Joe. Thank you.
Hey, well, anyways, I was going to mention that I caught the last hour when you mentioned Alternative 3.
Mm-hmm.
I just caught part of it, and I guarantee you will be interested in it.
Have you seen it?
That's what I've just watched part
of it. Oh, you were watching that part of it. Well, did it? Yeah. Is it scary?
Oh, yeah, it applies to a lot of what I've been listening to your program about.
Does it look real?
Well, yes, it did. It looked like it covers a lot of subjects today, that even though it was made back.
I get it. Did you see it on YouTube?
Yes.
Okay. We're going to probably smash that site, Olaf.
Well, it's an amazing film.
Also,
probably smash that indeed. Yeah. And you said it runs about 50 what?
I think it's like 52 minutes. It's under an hour.
Black and white?
No, it's in color, but it's a terrorizing 52 minutes. If you look at the subtext, you'll be... I don't know if I can watch it.
Is there screaming and yelling and stuff like that?
Oh, no. It's actually very calm. That's probably part of the reason it's frightening.
Is this something you should watch at night? After the show, for example?
You know, having been a long-time coast-to-coast listener, I would say yes, absolutely.
I love it. How's our buddy Clyde doing? You talk to him lately?
Oh, yeah, I talk to him quite often. He's doing very well.
Super. All right. Stay with us. We're going to come back and take final phone calls here on Coast to Coast AM as we talk about the secret space age. It's been going on for a long, long time. On our next Coast to Coast program, our dear friend Rosemary Ellen Guiley joins us along with John Zaffis as we talk about their latest work in the paranormal and the ghost arena. So stand by for that, followed by Open Lines on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Olaf Phillips with us. Olaf, have you looked at the very strange disappearances and or deaths of scientists?
I have, actually, in conjunction with doing the book. One of the things that is kind of prophesied by Alternative 3, I guess you could put it that way, is that there are scientists that are approached to join the program, and then they either join the program and move to wherever, or they die. And there's a Steve Quayle has actually done an amazing job of charting that.
Oh, he sure
has. It's amazing, but there's a huge laundry list of people who died, especially in the 80s around Marconi and the SDI work that they had done. That when they were working on these SDI projects, that large numbers of the people, senior scientists, senior technicians, actually, a lot of them died in car accidents. They died of heart attacks. They killed themselves. But there's quite a laundry list.
And the fact that there's so many in one particular group, that's what's so bizarre.
Yeah, I think at one point they were like dying two per month. I mean, it's really mind-boggling to actually look at it, to abstractly look at it and say, okay, all these people died in the space of 1 year.
What's your gut tell you? What's going on?
I think that they were sanitizing the program. I think that they were cleaning mm-hmm. up after themselves. Because if you have a project that you want to keep ultra secret, you know, people inherently talk. You can't help it. You know, the people just, they go to a bar, you know, they drink too much. They say, hey, I worked on this program.
Yeah, that's right.
They call into a show, you know, whatever. So how the best way to sanitize it is to either move them somewhere where they can't talk. They don't want to talk, then you have to kill them.
It's like that movie Breaking Bad. After you've
right.
made your methamphetamine, they bumped you off.
Yeah, it's Machiavellian, but yeah, pretty much.
All right, let's go to final calls here. We will pick it up by going to Irondale, Alabama. Jay's with us. Jay, let's get started. Go ahead.
Greetings from Railroad Capital of the United States.
Greetings indeed.
Yes, all train traffic eventually comes through here. When people do not want to believe something such as Sasquatch, that doesn't exist. Okay, the secret space program, that doesn't exist. The Skinwalker, which I do not want to ever meet, that doesn't exist. Doesn't exist to them because they want to tag it a conspiracy theory. It's like the book, Where Did the Towers Go? I think that's the book. I think you've had this woman on
yep.
before, George.
Judy Woods.
Yes. This doesn't exist. It's a conspiracy theory. You're one of those conspiracy theorists. No, I'm an outside-the-box thinker, and you never know what you're going to learn when you listen to Coast to Coast. Another great show. This has got to be one of your top 10 shows, George. You're knocking it out of the box. Just the underground bases, I knew, when I was in Europe, we had a keg party in an underground, it's an underground shell manufacturing plant. It was complete with everything. It had bathrooms, bunker, it was unreal. And it's just, people just do not believe. If you want to see something, look at the boring machine that's like 30 feet across that the U.S. Air Force has. But no, it doesn't exist. It's a conspiracy theory. Hey, from Starfleet Garage, beam me up, Scotty.
You got it. Off you go. Off you go, indeed. Well, Olive, he is right, Olive, about so many different things that have happened.
He is. And one of the things that he was pointing out about the underground bunkers having Barca lounges and stuff, one of the funniest things, I guess it's funny, but one of the strangest things that I found out is that in looking at some of these bunkers, like Site R, you know, Raven Rock, Mount Weather, NORAD, and all these facilities, I believe that Site R actually has a Starbucks. So you can write out the apocalypse with a mochaccino, and it has a gift shop. So I guess, you know, it's for celebrating birthdays, you know, as the surface of the earth is laid waste.
They'll learn how to market anything, won't they?
I guess so.
Let's go to Craig in Bradenton, Florida, east of the Rockies. Craig, go ahead.
Hey, George, how are you?
Good, Craig. Thanks.
Oh, good. I wanted to tell you a quick story. It'll be real fast.
Okay.
My grandma back in the 40s took me down to the fishing hole, and we were going about to fish. And Grandma said, Craig, take your shoes off. Don't get them muddy. So I proceeded to take my shoes off. And I said, Grandma, you're going to have to take your shoes off. She took her shoes off, and there it was. She had a big, hairy foot. And I saw Bigfoot that day, George.
And does any family members look like her?
Oh, just Grandma.
All right. It's about that time, Olaf. It's the bewitching hour.
She was a gigantopithecus.
She might have been. She might have been. Do you think this creature is the link between ape and man?
You know, I actually studied anthropology, and when I was taking physical anthropology, we actually had quite a discussion about Bigfoot. I think, based on what I know, I would say it's more of a cousin than a direct link. But, you know, today we used to see the progression of human development as kind of a tree. Now they're like parallel lines. So I think it's not so much a missing link necessarily, but more of a cousin, like a branch.
the skeptics, those non-believers, say, find me one, get me one. It's kind of tough.
It's tough. I mean, you're talking about an animal that, you know, that has survived by being shy, that it doesn't want to be around people. You know, only rarely do they come out so that you can see them. I mean, I saw 11 miles away. But there, you know, there is a hominid form, a Gigantopithecus, that fits the Bigfoot. And I think it's also, when you look at it, there's the Bigfoot, there's the Yeti. You know, they're all over the place. And I think that you can't discount that. It's like vampires. Every culture has a concept of vampires. Well, where does it come from? You know, so I would say it's definitely real.
First-time caller Dan is in Southgate, California. Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you gentlemen doing today?
Fine. Thank you.
Good, good. My question is you had mentioned that it all boils down to money, and then in some cases people have found purchase orders and things of that such. My question is if these bases exist, how do they resupply them, and particularly water? Because I can see rockets launching from where I live here in Southgate all the way over to Vandenberg. So obviously somebody's going to have to notice these things going up if these things are manned, I'm assuming.
Well, in terms of the water, I think they're just trucking it in, aren't they, Olaf?
Well, I think there are a couple of approaches, right? They could be recycling it. Like on a nuclear submarine, you know, they're recycling the water. So I think you could see some recycling. There's also known to be some water on the moon. There's definitely a bunch of water on Mars. It's also, you know, we're thinking the notion of, well, they're going to put these water tanks onto a rocket and they're going to launch them out of Vandenberg. And I don't think that's the way they do it. I think they use space planes, the triangles that people see, the other exotic aircraft that people have reported. I think that those are what they use to actually transport goods and materials, not a conventional rocket.
Kathy's up next in Marietta, California. Georgia, there she is. Hi, Kathy. Go ahead.
Hi. I heard you say that they're advanced like 100 years in advance. Is that correct? Is that what you said?
That they were 50 to 100 years advanced from what we think we have right now, yeah.
Okay, so NASA, was that like a front?
Yeah, I would argue that NASA is a kind of front. I mean, they have to be complicit in it because, you know, if their satellites see something they're not supposed to see, then they would be the ones that are airbrushing it out. But if you're going to cover up something of this magnitude, having a public space program would be an excellent way to cover it up. It's also a great way, as we saw with the Apollo missions and some of the other missions that we've had, to galvanize the public behind, you know, doing things. And I think it also helps to predictively program them, maybe, to get them ready for the idea. Because eventually, someday, they're going to have to say, hey, we're doing this stuff. It may be too late for most of us, but at some point, they're going to have to cop to it. And I think at that point, you know, we've been prepared. We know that it's possible, so it's not so extraordinary, and you won't have, like, civil disorder because of that.
All right, let's go out to Rome, New York. It's Howard's turn. Howard, good morning.
Hey, how are you guys?
Good, Howard.
Hey, my question is, why have we stopped landing on the moon? I mean, it's been almost half a century now, and I think that science would progress if we had a moon base there and, you know, did a lot of research from there. Wouldn't it be a better place than from a small little space station?
Absolutely. Here are the possibilities. One, we just didn't want to spend the money, so we stopped. Two, we were told not to go back by extraterrestrials. Or three, we kept going. And the program continues now. It's just a black ops program. Of those three scenarios, Olaf, which one do you think might it be?
I think it's three. Because, I mean, at this point, if we've been up there as long, I mean, the Army put forward Project Horizon in the late 50s with the idea that it would be operational by 1962. The Air Force with Lunex wanted to be operational by 63. So if we've been up there that long, landing on the moon and covering it up would be very complicated. because you've got to pick the right spot to make sure that, because the astronauts most likely don't know, so you're going to have to reroute any kind of traffic that you're have going on up there, air traffic control style. You're going to have to move that all around. You're going to have to pick the spot perfectly, and then you're going to have to constrain these poor guys to go up there. Say, well, I want to go and see stuff. I rode a missile to get to the moon, and I want to see things, and they're going to go driving around, and they're going to see the wrong thing. Then what do you do? So I think it's a very complicated procedure.
Let's take a few more calls here. We go to San Antonio, Texas now. Holland is with us. Holland, you're on with us. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay. Thanks.
I was wondering, what are y'all's theories on the dark side of the moon, if there's anything there or not?
Well, the remote viewer, the late Ingo Swann, believes that there were structures on the far side of the moon. Other people claim that there are other structures that seem like they are made out of glass. What do you get, Olaf?
I think we probably have fairly large, complex facilities on the dark side of the moon. I think that's probably what Ingo Swann was seeing. It, being on the dark side of the moon is a great place to put it, because down here we're not going to see it. So if they're carrying out operations, they can do it more free than if they did it on the near side. On the near side, they have to cover it up more.
Are they doing anything sinister up there?
Well, I mean, part of the Alternative 3 program is something called batch consignments, where they would kidnap large numbers of people to staff the facilities, kind of like slave labor.
Yeah.
I think that's fairly sinister. I don't know that they're planning to, like, viral bomb us or anything like that, but, you know, there are some definitely sinister aspects to the thing.
Well, there sure are. Andrew's in Appleton, Wisconsin. What do you got on your mind, Andrew, and thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hey, George, yeah. I was wondering if you have ever been approached by the CIA or members of the government, you know, telling you not to talk too much about this or let guests or callers talk too much about that, or have anything weird happen to you throughout the years.
Hold on. Let me check with some people here. No, actually.
Are you an alien? How far does the rabbit hole go, George?
In my entire career, Andrew, my entire career, I've never been approached by government or management to be told what to or what not to do on the program, ever. Maybe I'm lucky, Olaf, huh?
Yeah, I mean, other people have been, so I would say you're very lucky.
Vinny is in Corning, California, west of the Rockies. Vinny, you're up with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I did some research into the Admiral Byrd expedition back in late, when he undertook his expedition to the Antarctic, back in late December of 1946 or January 47. What I found out is that apparently they believed or thought that there was some type of a Nazi stronghold at that bottom of the earth, and so they pursued efforts to try and, you know, undertake find out what's going on. And supposedly, from quotations from Admiral Byrd, was that they were under attack by a sophisticated military hardware that was beyond our technology. Do you recall that? Do you recall that scenario? I mean, to the effect that what Admiral Byrd had explained during the course of the expedition, and it was cut short. It was
supposedly he made that statement to an Argentinian newspaper, and the base that he was supposed to attack was Base 211. That's on New Schwabenland. It's a Queen Maud land on the far side of Antarctica, and the expedition was actually very short. It lasted, I think, a quarter of the time it was supposed to be there. And basically, one day they just packed up, and Byrd was like, I'm out of here, and they just left. They went to Buenos Aires. But, yeah, supposedly they had a fight. Several aircraft were shot down, including a Martin Mariner, and the entire crew was killed.
Well, his record, his journal, some people think it's authentic, other people think not. I'm not sure.
Me neither. I mean, it's, you know, when you're dealing with something like that, that could be very controversial. I mean, history has shown us that things like that can be edited.
Absolutely.
Especially post-mortem. So, yeah.
Everett is in Tennessee, and we'll get you in here. Everett, go ahead.
Yes, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good, Ev.
Yes, I got a question. I mean, with all the satellites
we got, you know, we got up there in orbit. I mean, how is it possible that we hadn't captured a picture of a Bigfoot? I mean, I could sit here in my house and look at my house, my car, and I mean, just anywhere. I can just look anywhere I want in the world and get a picture of anything. Why hasn't it been caught on satellites yet?
Well, on satellites, I'm not sure. Maybe they have something. I know Jeff Meldrum wants to do an infrared type of picture approach in a balloon, but probably just a matter of time, Olive, when they get this wrapped up.
You know, they may have it. I mean, there are the stories of Mount Ararat and Noah's Ark, right? Once they found that structure, they found was Noah's Ark, that the CIA flew like 10 U-2 missions over photographing it. So within the government, there definitely are elements of the government that are interested in that kind of stuff. The problem with satellites, though, is that you have to position it to a certain area to want to get that photography. So, you know, you're talking about a moving target. You don't know where it is, so you're making an estimate of where it would be.
Good point. Mr. Phillips, thank you so much. The Secret Space Age. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Ladasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.